Welcome to the next Euromigos Paper of the Month. This is an unusual month. It's November's Paper of the Month. So it's not November that it's unusual. It's unusual because in a slightly, I guess it's an unbiased manner, we've picked a paper which Brian's involved with, which I think I was opposed to, by the way. Brian insisted.
Not true.
The title is Molecular Subsets in Renal Cancer, Determine Outcome to Checkpoints and Angiogenesis Blockade. And essentially, it's a paper, which I am going to introduce Kim in a second, by the way, Brian. it's a paper which stems from a previous publication, which Dave McDermott led. And essentially, this is metastatic clear cell kidney cancer. Patients' tumours had RNA sequencing performed, and with those we performed unbiased analysis looking for subgroups, and an angiogenic signature was found, and that correlated with Goodrich disease in response to sunitinib. An immunogenic signature was identified, which was somewhat distinct from the angiogenic signature, and that was associated with genes like interferon gamma, and that was associated with response to atezolizumab. And then a third stromal signature was identified, which appeared to be essentially immune inhibitory, and there was a debate about whether bevacizumab can overcome that. And so today we're joined by Kim Rathmau, who, Kim, would you like to introduce yourself once I've finished this rather long spiel? And Kim's going to describe this subsequent paper after Brian just talks in 30 seconds about what he did. So, Kim, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Kim Rathmau. I'm a medical oncologist focused in kidney cancer and have been working in the biomarker field for several years.
And really, Kim, is it true that you're Brian's boss?
Tom, she's my boss's boss. So let's keep the swearing to a minimum here and the insulting, please.
It must be a very difficult job. I don't envy you at all. I imagine there'd be some very difficult conversations early on. So, Brian, would you like to describe very quickly what you did?
So basically, this was correlate data from the EMOTION 151, which was the phase 3 of atezo-bev versus sunitinib, which, unfortunately didn't have the clinical effect, but I think the greatest contribution from the EMOTION series in RCC is the correlates, and you described 150. So this was basically just expanded. It was 823 baseline tumors, mostly primaries, but some metastatic tumors that were subjected to RNA sequencing, DNA sequencing, some immunohistochemistry, et cetera. So just an expansive analysis of these tumors. And just to cut to the chase, using this unsupervised clustering algorithm, divided them into 7 clusters. And if you look at sort of figure 6 in the paper, it sort of lays them out into basically more angiogenic clusters, ones that are more inflammatory, and ones that aren't either, which I think perhaps is somewhat the most interesting, that have to do with, oxidative pathways and metabolism. So I think it really nicely defines the biology of kidney cancer. And we can talk in a bit about some of the clinical correlates.
Kim, what did you think of it?
Yeah, I really like this paper. So actually, I think it is appropriate that you picked it. I'll say that we had, independent of this invitation, put it on our list for our Journal Club of my lab.
See, Tom? See?
That's only because you work there, Brian.
You're not going to get a raise or anything.
Right. Let's be clear.
So I like this paper for a couple reasons. One, I also have to say I'm very jealous that you got to be the one that put this out there, because we've wanted to make some of these findings for a long time, but it took a big data set like this with therapy to be able to make these determinations. So, it's a gene expression coupled with good deep mutation profiling in a large subset of patients. I think the things that I liked about the paper, a lot of people have done these segments into subclassifications, but you had a big enough group of patients that you could do some discovery. I think of these kinds of, like, right away in your, I think it's like figure 1A, the panel with the classifications, the NMS string. There are two ways to do that. One is you do that and then look for things, patterns that you can recognize there. And that's what a lot of groups have been doing, and that's how you come up with angiogenesis and immune signatures and EMT and things. And the approach we'd always wanted to take was to do that and then, you know, put the blinders on and then see if you could discover something new. And this did that as well. And cluster 7, I think, is super exciting. The snow RNA.
Kim, could you talk about cluster 7 in a second, just for a second? Because it is something that's, because all of the other signatures either have an angiogenic or an immune component or a stromal or a cell cycle component, which I think many people understand. But the SNORNA cluster 7, I don't think many people do understand.
No, and I'm not sure I understand it either. But I took away from that cluster that we need to go looking at these snow RNAs and understand what they do. I thought the association with SETI2 mutation was really fascinating. And, you know, the idea that there's some subset that's really epigenetically driven. Mm-hmm. I think that's what that set's
and
telling us.
Kim, what does it mean by epigenetically driven? What does it mean?
How much epidemic going on now?
I can't get my mind away from the epidemic. Yeah, or pandemic. Epigenetic drivers, what does it mean in cancer? How do you target it? What would you do with that cluster next?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to unpack epigenetics. There's methylation changes that result in classical transcriptional targets and downstream effectors that way. But I think more and more epigenetics is going to affect the not just the levels of transcript, but the levels of protein that's translated. I think also there's some ultrastructure of the chromatin and will lead to associations because of physical proximity of genes that are not normally linearly linked. So I don't think many people in our field know a lot about snow RNAs.
Yeah, I got to say, I had never heard of it until these data came out.
So, well, I read this paper and I had to look them up.
This is a new area for
tribal
research.
Global RNA. Yeah, so this could be totally protein translation driven.
And it was only, cool. That cluster was only 3%, so it's a relative handful of tumors. Yeah. But if you look at, you know, those, the hazard ratio for benefit with atezo-bev is sort of off the charts. And I can tell you, we're looking at overall survival too, you know, and so these patients do exceedingly well, you know, with an immune-based therapy. Again, small numbers, but even looking at those outliers, it might offer some insight into immune responsiveness.
Yep, I've been involved with some molecular classifications in my time in bladder cancer, and I've been, the people involved, someone sat down with me and just said, well, Tom, it's like stamp collecting, isn't it? You've gone out, you've done an exercise, you've done an analysis, you've brought different groups together because of their gene expression, but actually some have FGF mutations and others have PD-L1 abnormalities. And actually it's just a mixed match. And these groups actually mean nothing. Shouldn't we actually be looking at specific targets and attacking those specific targets rather than attempting to generate false molecular classifications which have a mismatch of different gene expression and mutation abnormalities? What's the point of the exercise?
Oh, I think that the early stages of this, that statement was true, that it was too rough and the early biomarkers that we put forward, for example, the CCA and CCB, there just was too much noise in there. But I think kidney cancer hasn't lent itself to sort of one gene, one target as a lung cancer model. I think these kinds of more digital type models where you have A and B and D, but not C puts you in one class, where A, B and C puts you in a different class, is probably the way we're gonna go. And I think I liked this paper also because I felt like for the first time it was distilled to things that we could really do as a biomarker. You suggest kind of going down the transcript route, which we could do, but I think even just the DNA alterations pretty reliably look like they classified these tumors. Mm. And the association with you know, choosing a therapy now makes it relevant. The other thing I think was our biomarker segregations didn't have much relevance.
Kim, could you talk about, we did some work together with DNA alterations previously in kidney cancer. Could you talk about where you think we are from a DNA alteration perspective in kidney cancer and what the data we've seen here adds to that? Because we very rarely talk about mutations in kidney cancer. And this is obviously a very in-depth piece of work in that. But there has been some work and people have talked about PBRM1 and other bits and pieces. Where are we with DNA alterations in kidney cancer?
Yeah, I mean, right now we're not using them at all. But I think you know, this is a great example, and PBRM1 is one that comes through really strongly as a better risk disease, more angiogenic, sort of more the classical features, clear cell type renal cell carcinoma. You know, I think we've had VHL for a long, long time, and that doesn't help us very much because there's only a subset, very small subset that don't have VHL mutation. So it's going to be all these secondary drivers. I think that the heterogeneity, that's one thing I wanted to ask Brian about, how you thought about heterogeneity in this paper, that the heterogeneity story has been really important for us, but has maybe caused us to, you know, step back from actually, you know, applying genetics, you know, because of concern that, you know, if this sample has this mutation, the next sample may not, maybe we shouldn't use these. But I think actually, you know, data like this tells you like where those strong drivers are, like PBRM1. I think these KDMs are also really interesting, KDM5C. And
we're going to ask Brian two questions, one about heterogeneity and then the other about where we go next. But before we get there, Kim, would you like to just talk really briefly about your work in heterogeneity? And because you've done some work with sequential tissue with VEGF-targeted therapy, which I thought was quite interesting and contradicted some of the previous work. And I think that was published recently. Do you want to talk about your take on kidney cancer heterogeneity as it currently stands?
I think we're understanding that it's actually the base profile that helps determine whether a tumor will be one of these very heterogeneous phenotypes or maintains a more clonal evolution type of a pattern. It's actually Samra's work that I think puts that together the most nicely. We've done some as well. I think that if you subsample in a tumor, there is some heterogeneity. And again, there are some tumors that are off the charts in heterogeneity, but most of them have features that are fairly stable. In the paper that you're referencing, though, interestingly, when we sampled tumors before and after they received a VEGFR inhibitor, there were fewer mutations in the samples that we sort of a restriction of allele frequencies. So it seemed like you, in my mind, kind of got rid of the riffraff and you were down now to more what the core driver mutations were after you'd had the response to an anti-angiogenic.
So Brian, you've got your seven groups. You've clustered them successfully. You've done RNA sequencing and whole exome sequencing. There's a bit of protein analysis there too with PD-L1 expression. You've given sunitinib to half of them and the other half of bevacizumab, which is probably a less active VEGF-targeted therapy, and atezolizumab, which is obviously a PD-L1 inhibitor. So you've shown that some of the groups have a higher angiogenic signature, and guess what? They do better with sunitinib. You've shown some of the groups have a higher immune signature, and guess what? They do better with atezolizumab. And then there are some other groups which are more complex, some cell cycle groups which also have an immune signature, and they seem to be a bit somewhere in the middle. Seven groups sounds a lot. What do you do next?
So let me comment on the heterogeneity thing. I mean, we really weren't able to look carefully at heterogeneity in this study, obviously, because we didn't have separate samples from each primary and metastatic. I would say the one thing, and this was, I think, in response to a reviewer, was looking at primary versus metastatic. And there didn't seem to be a big difference in terms of the cluster distribution, for what it's worth. Again, that wasn't on an individual patient level, but across patients and across clusters. But it didn't look like the primaries were of one type cluster and then mets were something totally different. So that's about all I think we can say for heterogeneity. Where do we go next? I mean, I think the work... There's seven clusters, but they sort of cluster together. You know, one and two are angiogenic, and they were named, I think, angiogenesis and angiogenic proliferative, and four and five are more inflammatory. So there's probably three or four main clusters in here. Where we really need to go is to do biomarker selection and prospective trials, right? We talk about it a lot. We haven't done it in kidney cancer. I think these data are tools to maybe finally do that, because we see some signals here, but unfortunately, the best correlate data is coming from the trial with sort of the weakest clinical data. And as you say, bevacizumab, maybe not the best angiogenesis inhibitor, and PD-L1s probably not as good as PD-1s in RCC. So we need to
although
look
I
at
think
the...
That, although I think that statement is a complicated one.
It's a complicated one, but that's my opinion. We can talk about that separately. But anyway, I think we need to take the regimens that we're using in clinic and that have shown survival advantages and see if we can't tease out differential benefit based on gene expression. How exactly to do that, it's difficult, as you know.
Kim, we've been debating or arguing for some time about biomarkers in kidney cancer in various forums over the last few months. I tend to come second best in the debate. I wish you were on my team if you would like to join this bandwagon. It's not a very happy one, and we're not making much progress. But Kim, one of the questions that I've got for you is, what do we do next with this data? Is this data which needs to go back to the laboratory, and we need to get lots of different people working in basic science labs, unpicking it, looking in more detail? Or actually, do we take this data and put it in the clinic and try and randomize patients based off these signatures and try and improve therapies? What's the answer to that question? Or is this just something that's going to end up on the floor of stamp collection like some of the other analysis?
I certainly hope not.
So yeah, how do we stop that happening?
I think actually we have the tools to start taking this to the clinic. And there are labs that will continue looking for new biomarkers. But I think, you know, the last 5 years, we keep coming around to mostly the same set. And they're now, the tools are robust. We feel reliable about knowing what a mutation is or is not. You know, we don't have a lot of variants that we're unclear about. You know, I think we could be bringing this. And we have a variety of tools to treat patients with right now. We have angiogenic therapy and immunotherapy and mTOR-driven therapy and combinations. And, we're in the midst now of debating about what you use and what you use in which patients. This can finally sort patients out so that you could have a more meaningful conversation. Then you might be one of the winners. So let's give you this. But to say, you know, you're very likely to respond to a single agent therapy for a very long time. Given the profile of your tumor, that's probably the best option. I think patients really want to know honest answers, not just, you know, what might be in a very unselected group of patients.
And Kim, my question, do you think that individual genes matter? Because as you say, from your CCA-CCB work, genomic health work that I've done, other groups, we all keep finding the same families, although they might be different genes. Do you think the individual gene components matter, or is it just the family, the concept, if you will?
Oh, I think you know, this data makes it look like it's really just the family. I started by making the argument about going to genes, just that they're sort of reliable, but they all seem to end in the same transcript profile. So I think transcript profile, if we have a good tool to use, it would be totally fine. So I think we just need to get a couple of these out there and see if we can make some better predictions for patients so that it's meaningful in what we do.
Well, and I think, as you say, right now we're just empirically applying doublets to patients, and you know, you believe in one set of data or the other, you have your favorite regimen. But if we can use these data to, I would say, intensify therapy in appropriate patients, but also, as you pointed out, to de-intensify therapy would probably be perhaps even the biggest advance, right? Patients who can get away with monotherapy with limited toxicity would probably be, you know, among the winners.
Exactly. The other pieces that come out of this data are, the co-segregation of all of those TFE3 patients. Proliferation. I think BAP1, also not surprising that it ended up in clusters 4 and 5, or 3 and 4, wherever it ended up, in the proliferative type clusters.
And, you know, Kim, what do you think? Because that issue around the cell cycle genes, it pops up really prominently in this paper. And it's not something which kidney cancer doctors have really talked about much before. Should we be using cell cycle inhibitor type drugs? What is this group of patients? Why are cell cycle genes suddenly relevant in kidney cancer?
Well, I think most of our studies previously were smaller subsets, right? So, you know, the dominant signature is still the VHL-PBRM1. The CDKN2As, the P53s, those are smaller groups. So they didn't come out early, I think. But I think we should be thinking about cell cycle inhibitors. I loved the discussion actually said that maybe we should be thinking about chemotherapeutics, right? There may be some group of patients who could benefit greatly by those kinds of drugs. And I'm finding it, you know, interesting. We use DNA sequencing now way in the back end, you know, after we've exhausted all lines of therapy, and then we test and we end up often not finding anything that's helpful, but we find, oh, they had a BAP1 mutation. Ah, that explained everything that we saw in the last year. So wouldn't it be nice if we knew that at the beginning and could say, you know, this is what we're dealing with. Let's.
Last question for both of you. What routine molecular analysis do you do for your frontline kidney cancer patients beyond looking to define clear cell or papillary renal cancer?
So as Kim just said, I mean, if I do any sort of sequencing, I tend to do it in refractory patients as sort of a Hail Mary, hoping to find something. But we're not routinely doing it up front. But I totally agree. If we can find clinically actionable information, then I think it'll move, you know, earlier in the sequence.
It looks to me like RNA signatures are more important than the classic Foundation One gene DNA alteration panels. How do we move to an RNA platform and routinely measure those in a timely manner?
Yeah, there are lots of good RNA platforms out there that these can be applied with. So
you think this is just off the shelf, we just need to get them and do this? Or do you think it's still beyond the scope of what we should be routinely doing?
Oh, I wish I could say we should just do it for everyone. But I think we should be doing trials that get us to doing it for everyone.
So trials first, not currently changing anything from a molecular analysis perspective. Prospective studies based off these types of signatures, maybe combining two or three groups together, and then immune therapy, perhaps de-escalating to immune single agent rather than immune combination. And obviously in the angiogenic signatures, angiogenesis plus immune checkpoint inhibitors. Is that the trial design we're looking at?
Exactly. I think we need to look at PD-1. We need to look at PD-1, CTLA-4. Like, we need to look at all of our current therapies, but we have the tools and we need to just take them, not keep rediscovering them.
Hey, Tom, can I make up one more point?
Yes, I think so.
So, you know, we talk a lot about IMDC risk and subsets and how did Ipi-Nivo do and blah, blah, blah. We spend a lot of time on that, you know, somewhat appropriately. If you look, though, these clusters really, they're represented in each of the clinical risk groups. So if you look at, I think it's figure 2A, although clearly favorable has, you know, more of the angiogenic clusters and poor has more of the inflammatory. It really shows that the biology is not, you know, those clinical risk groups aren't homogenous when it comes to biology. They're very heterogeneous. And I think we're hopefully getting to a day where we'll move away from just those clinical risk groups and have biologic risk groups, right? I think that's what we're after.
But we did a podcast with Danny on this risk group thing. Yep. And I think we were pretty, it was the beginning of our world tour. And it was actually got off to a terrible start, if you remember. The restaurant wasn't good because he didn't like the fish food. I think there was a problem there. And then we upset Danny because we didn't like his scoring system. And it was a disastrous podcast, by recollection. But how long will we be using the IDM, you know, the full blood count as the determinant for how we treat patients with kidney cancer? It doesn't make a huge amount of sense to me. And actually, it was designed for VEGF targeted therapy, and it distinguishes quite nicely sunitinib into good, intermediate, and poorest patients. But actually, Ipi-Nivo, the reason why Ipi-Nivo doesn't work so well in the good risk patients and works well in the intermediate and poor is it's not distinguishing between the three groups at all. All the patients are doing about the same. And that's why, you know, the benefits obviously in that poor risk group, clearly it don't have VEGF driven tumors. You guys have all shown that. And we do now need, if we're going to move into this immune therapy era, we do need to move into a different way of classifying these patients. And Danny's idea of using blood parameters in conjunction with molecular parameters, and perhaps even bringing PD-L1 in as a biomarker initially, because we know that actually it does seem to be some enrichment with Ipi-Nivo in that group, I think makes a lot of sense. I would like us to have a consensus sort of kind of meeting when this pandemic is over. Kim, I haven't thought of this before, but you're very invited to come along. Perhaps you should chair it, actually, because Brian and I should, said it should be nowhere near that. And we should get a group together and actually work out what the new classification should look like and whether it's practical or not. Because, you know, can we practically be say we're going to use an RNA signature within that classification and then try and validate it and move forward that way? I'd love to do that. I think Danny's trying to do it as well, so we probably ought to invite him, Brian.
Totally agree. Go ahead.
I think IMDC, you know, had when it was the only thing we had, it was a great tool, but it just doesn't get to this kind of level of depth. And one thing I will just add, you know, looking at blood levels, blood cell levels, is really challenged as you look. So we just had a really exciting grand rounds at Vanderbilt this week on genetic ancestry and genes in various races and how those drive blood levels. So how do we know that those marks are really going to be relevant across patient populations? So I think moving to something that's really patient-based is precision medicine the way we need to do it right.
Brian, totally, we're 5 minutes over. We've gone on much longer than we normally do, because I think it's been fantastic, Kim. Thank you very much for your time today, and thanks for being so positive about Brian's work, which is unusual.
And I don't think I've done anything to jeopardize my employment either. So
at this point, it seems safe. Yeah, at this point. I see you both very soon indeed. Thanks very much.
Thank you.